In 1983, the Grameen Bank was established with the goal of lifting people in developing countries out of poverty by offering them financial services. The Grameen Bank has been the model for numerous microfinance and social entrepreneurship firms around the world. Agora Partnerships is a firm of social entrepreneurs that works to level the playing field for socially responsible entrepreneurs from developing countries, giving them access to strategy, networks, and capital. Women's World Banking works to expand the economic assets, participation, and power of low-income women entrepreneurs by helping them access financial services and information. Tonight's program hosts four panelists: Camilla Nestor, Director of the Capital Management and Advisory Center at the Grameen Foundation; Hans Delian, the Senior Manager of Microfinance Products and Services at Women's World Banking; Ben Powell, the co-founder and managing partner of Agora Partnerships; and Craig Weeks, Senior Vice President on the Treasury Services Division at J.P. Morgan Chase in New York and a Dickinson graduate of the class of 1977. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of the program. Thank you, and now please join me in welcoming our panel.
So I'm Craig Weeks, and I did graduate from Dickinson. It's a pleasure to be here. Heather Merrill assured me that she's intervened with the Carlisle police that none of the parking tickets that I got in 75 are still are likely to come back and haunt me. So I'm safe for another night. But I did want to thank you all for coming and thank the panelists for being here tonight. What our format is going to be, we will start with short 5 to 10 minute presentations by each of the panelists. And then I will ask them collectively one or two questions, and then we'll open it up to the wider audience from there. And we will ask Camilla Nestor from Grameen to kick off her presentation first.
Great to be here. I'm Camilla Nestor. I'm the director of the Capital Management and Advisory Center at Grameen Foundation. I'll explain more about both what Grameen Foundation is and what our particular group does. Grameen Foundation was founded in 1997 by our current president, Alex Counts, with support from Dr. Muhammad Yunus, to replicate the successes of the Grameen Bank in other countries around the world. We work through 50 microfinance institutions, which we call MFIs for short, around the world. We're very active in Asia, Latin America, Middle East, North Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa. Those 50 microfinance institutions that we work with collectively serve about 4 million microfinance clients. We are working through those microfinance institutions in three main ways. We're helping them with innovative technology to reach larger numbers of people at lower costs. And we are helping them also with financing and technical assistance in a number of areas. Just wanted to say a word about the Grameen family of organizations. The Grameen Bank in Bangladesh is obviously the pioneer organization in the Grameen family and was one of the first implementers of microfinance, although there are many organizations that were doing microfinance about the same time that Muhammad Yunus founded the Grameen Bank. He just managed to do it on a massive scale. And he has been a real pioneer and champion of replicating the successes in Bangladesh globally. So we are separate from the Grameen Bank, but we are driven by their original mission and vision, and Muhammad Yunus continues to play a large role in our work as well. You'll hear other Grameen names as well. In Bangladesh, there's Grameen Phone, which is a for-profit company that is in the Grameen Bank of Families. You have Grameen Shakti, which is a clean energy company in Bangladesh. So Muhammad Yunus has you know, looks at microfinance as one of many social businesses. And after the successes of the Grameen Bank were solidified, he started moving on to solving other social problems from a business perspective. Within Grameen Foundation, we are based in Washington, D.C., and we also have a technology center based in Seattle, Washington. And we have three main groups. We have the Capital Management and Advisory Center, my group, and our goal, very simply, is to connect microfinance institutions with sources of commercial capital, whether it's local financial markets or international capital markets. We have our regional programs that provides technical assistance to microfinance institutions in areas that they may need support on, like human resources development is one example of an area that many microfinance institutions are finding to be a big challenge. Just to give you an example, one of the MFIs we work with in India is hiring and training 1,000 new loan officers a year, which is just, you know, it's a massive scale. You need to have a standardized training program in place. So there are many microfinance institutions that are grappling with issues of human resources development. And third, there are some really interesting, innovative things going on there. They are staffed by a bunch of ex-Microsoft people who all come from, you know, the technology world on the West Coast, and they are developing innovative, cutting-edge technology microfinance further beyond its current reach. The Center at Grameen Foundation. The market estimate for the demand for microfinance is about $300 billion globally. The current outstanding loan portfolios, aggregate loan portfolios of all microfinance institutions globally, is in the range of about $20 billion. So there's an estimated unmet demand of about $280 billion. There's, you know, really no way you can meet that kind of capital gap through soft sources of financing. You need to go to financial and capital markets. It needs to be commercial financing. Obviously, financing is not the only input needed. You need a lot of capacity building and support to get the institutions to the point where they can absorb all that capital as well. And what we're doing in our group, we are focusing on linking up the microfinance institutions that we partner with globally with local commercial banks, local capital markets players, and also international financial institutions and commercial sources of financing. And one of the key focuses for us has been developing local currency financing sources for microfinance institutions. And I'll just say one word about this because it's a really important issue from Grameen's perspective. Microfinance institutions generate their revenue all in local currency. If they are taking on funding to fund their loan portfolios in US dollars or euros, they are taking on a huge amount of foreign currency risk. So what we're trying to do is get local currency financing sources to MFIs to match their local currency loans to the end borrowers. And there are a number of innovative ways people in the industry are doing this, but it's become a real focus recently in terms of the capital market space in microfinance. And I'll leave it at that. Happy to take questions at any point, but just wanted to point out the local aspect that we are really working to develop local financial markets for microfinance so that they're not relying on, necessarily on international sources of funding going forward.
I am a little bit more kind of nervous than her, so I will probably moving a little bit. I will need to change the presentation first. I will touch some of the topics that she already mentioned, so I will just move faster there. First, what is Women's World Banking? And our mission is to have a major impact on expanding expanding economic assets, participation, and power of low-income women as entrepreneurs and also economic agents. And this we do by offering her then the opportunity to make businesses through financing their businesses. We are also a global network, and we have institutions in Latin America, Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe and Middle East. Similar to them, we have a network of 40 institutions in, reaching 8 million clients, approximately. I want to talk more, to give you a flavor of what are the challenges of the micro-entrepreneurs. No? Why banks have not been able to reach them in the past. No? And here are some of them. First is the large volumes of small loans that usually for traditional banks is very difficult because of their cost structure to offer these small loans. The second is asymmetric information, meaning that banks need to lend them money. They need to understand the size of your business, your repayment capacity. And to do that, they need records. And micro entrepreneurs, they don't have records. So for banks, it's very difficult to understand and lend. That was the second big challenge. And the third also is lack of collateral. Traditionally, banks have asked for a house or a car or a collateral. In most cases, micro entrepreneurs don't have. Another problem is that to reach them, you need to be in the neighborhoods, and they are dispersed in wide areas. Banks usually have a very centralized decision process through credit bureaus and scoring models. With microfinance, most of these people are informal. They don't have also records in any credit bureau. So it's very hard to model econometric scorings for them without data. So those are kind of the major challenges. And then how microfinance was able to overcome those challenges, I will, in my next slide, explain a little bit. But before I go there, the expectations from clients also are very similar to the ones you have when you go to a bank. First, and particularly them, because are people with low educational levels, they are looking and they feel comfortable when you offer them simple requirements, few steps, simple rules. Access the loan, accessible guarantees, clear and transparent information, meaning you cannot have a contract of 5 pages. Usually contracts should be half a page or 1 page with very simple messages, very simple rules. You know? And also they need permanent access. You know, you can, and to offer permanent access, you need to be sustainable. And here is the tension between sustainability, you know, and also the issue of charging the adequate interest rate to be sustainable. And some people are actually criticizing strongly why microfinance is charging 40% a year, 30% a year to poor people. No? But if you look at our cost structure, and if you look what we have achieved, still that 30% or 40% is, for them, is a very interesting interest rate, because the option, the alternative option will be a moneylender that charge probably more. And the other important characteristic of the service is you need to be able to disburse a loan, if possible, in 4 days, 3 days. And many of you will say, but 3 days? I can go through the internet and in 2 hours I will get a credit card approval. But technology and information enable banks in the U.S. and developed countries to be so fast. But in developing countries, you don't have that infrastructure. So if you disburse in 3 days, it's kind of a huge difference compared to a couple of years ago that you required a month to disburse a loan. And another important characteristic is you need to have a friendly environment with staff that will communicate and relate with these people, that won't threaten them, and that they will feel kind of at home. So that the type of staff we hire is totally different profile as a banker. That are more, you know, analytical, cold, and sophisticated. And without any comparison here. Okay, this is some microfinance institutions in Colombia, in Medellin, actually. If you look, they look like banks, very professional, but they're very friendly and open, no? So we have all these characteristics I already mentioned, no? And here I want to show you three types of entrepreneurs or micro-entrepreneurs that we serve. And here I want to emphasize some of the differences. The first one is a small one, and you will see there the three ranges is the net profit or the net income of that business monthly. One is $100 and less. The medium is between $100 and $375 per month, and the large one is $375 and more. But if you look at the... Do you have a laser here? Okay. If you look at the sales, monthly sales, 1,000 to 9,000. So it's a big difference. But when you look at them, they look all the same. But there are real difference in the incomes. Here you see the profits of that particular business from $66 per month to $1,300. Also, another important aspect is the other family incomes. $200, $500. And if you look at the business income over total income, you see that small ones are very diversified. So the business income only represents 29% of their total income, while the larger ones, 84% comes from the main business. So these people really rely on the big business. While the small ones, they, because it's small and very seasonal, they need to have different sources of income. At the end, we have here the repayment capacity. And you see big differences. $100 per month, this is what they have available, disposable income at the end of the month, to $1,000. So 10 times. And if you look at these people in the streets, in Colombia or in Africa, for you, for your eye, they will look the same. But they have different needs, different repayment capacities. And one of the problems with microfinance in the past, that the technology that we developed was not able to segregate and segment those needs. But microfinance has evolved, and now we have also different products, and we now are able to understand those differences and are able to offer better products. And here we have the two types of methodologies that are used, the individual loans and the group. Grameen is one of the most important group lending technologies, and Finca. And basically, this technology is very effective in targeting small businesses, $100, $200 loans, while the individual loans are more effective targeting $500 to $3,000 loans, because then you are able to do cash flows and understand better the repayment capacity. I won't go into the details of the differences, but I will only say that one, the group methodology outsources the repayment capacity assessment to the group. While the individual lending methodology, the institution will send a loan officer to the business and to the house to understand their cash flows and the repayment capacity. So that technology, the individual lending, is more costly. And therefore, you cannot lend small loans with that, while this is more effective lending to small loans. The disadvantage of this one is that you don't get to know very well your clients because you don't have that information. And in the long term, you will offer not so good quality services to them because you don't know them so well compared to this other technology. So I will talk a little to finalize how technology is helping microfinance reduce the transactional cost, and make more objective decisions, no? And here we have seen some technology innovations. The first one is MIS, that is back-end systems, no? It's amazing, you see, but this is obvious that banks should have all back-end systems. If you go to Asia, 80% of the institutions work with systems, manual systems. So they manage 1 million clients manually. And you can say, wow, how can they do that? But they do it, and they do it very efficiently. But it has limitations. And the other one, the other technology that we are using is a streamlining lending process, meaning automatizing the analysis. No? And the third one is trying to make more efficient the distribution channels. So these are the three areas where technology is helping us. Managing our back-end operations, helping us becoming more efficient through automatization of the risk assessment. And the third one is helping us reduce our transactional costs via ATM, kiosk, mobile technology, phones, and reaching clients with a lower cost. So I think technology will have a huge impact in the future in microfinance, and I think in the morning or before in the afternoon we were talking about the level of sophistication of this field and how now we are relying more and more on IT experts, financial experts, organizational experts, consulting firms that do strategy work, because microfinance has become a more kind of small, sophisticated banks. Thank you very much.
To sit down. Okay, well, first of all, thank you all for bearing this weather and coming out. I'm going to talk a little bit about Agora Partnerships, and I'm going to give my talk just a slightly different spin. We don't have the very impressive track record that Women's World Banking and the Grameen Foundation do of really helping to build the field of microfinance. So I'm going to talk more about how we have tried to identify opportunity to create social change and our model and how we're going about it. And the first thing you should know is that Agora Partnerships, we're a nonprofit. Our mission is to partner with entrepreneurs to help them create social responsible companies that can create jobs and help fight poverty. And we have been in existence for about 3 years. And we're now at a stage where we're beginning to scale and beginning to get a lot of traction. So, you know, I think when you think about starting a new social venture, there are basically two things you have to really think hard about and be sure about before you do it. Number one is, what is your theory of social change? You know, what is your organization going to do that is going to create some sort of systemic change that will improve people's lives in a sustainable way? And for us, we looked at what the microfinance industry has done, and we looked at the central insight of microfinance, which is that the poor are bankable. And we decided, what if we could extend that principle to small business entrepreneurs operating in the formal economy? So these are entrepreneurs that are a little bit more advanced than your typical microfinance entrepreneur. These are entrepreneurs who have a formal economy company, so they're paying taxes, they're able to export, they're able to grow their businesses. And you know, what if we could figure out how to provide to them strategy and financing and access to networks and all these sorts of business support services that you need to create a small business? So for us, our theory of change is that when a society becomes more entrepreneurial and you get more and more small businesses being developed, this creates a ripple effect and a virtuous circle where the small business sets an example, it hires people, it contributes to the community. All of a sudden, other entrepreneurs say, wow, if he did it, maybe I can do it too. Maybe I should think beyond what I thought my destiny was and try to think bigger. And then all of a sudden, you create a group of small business entrepreneurs. Maybe they create an association. They start to advocate for the rights of small business owners, and they start to reduce regulations. They start to put pressure against corruption. And all of a sudden, you have a new group of stakeholders in society that is trying to move that society forward. So that is our basic theory of change, that entrepreneurs are absolutely key to development and that we need to find ways of supporting them. Now, the second thing you have to think about when you're starting a new organization is there anybody else out there that's already doing this? Because it's a lot of work to start your own organization. And there's probably already some other organization that's doing it already, and maybe you should help them. So we spent a lot of time mapping out and scoping out this industry and trying to figure out who is helping small businesses, and especially who is providing capital, long-term capital, growth capital, the kind of capital that businesses need to actually grow. And we discovered that while there was a lot of activity and insight in the microfinance field, in this micro-venture capital field, there was really very few players. And so the combination of what we thought was a very powerful theory of change plus the fact that no one else was doing it made us decide, okay, let's try to start a new organization. Now, we really believe that there is an enormous amount of potential among small business entrepreneurs to transform their communities. The problem is it is extremely difficult for these entrepreneurs to succeed. And there are lots of reasons for this, and I'll just mention a couple. Number one is there's barriers of entry. So it's very difficult to break in to business networks to actually start your business. In Nicaragua, it takes, on average, 40 days to start a new business. It's extremely expensive. And so you see very few people actually saying, I can start a business and trying. And so many talented entrepreneurs are on the sidelines when they should be in the game helping their communities grow. Another big problem is simple lack of education and experience. So there are many opportunities that entrepreneurs, if they may be standing on a great opportunity, but they just don't know it because they have not had any formal training and they just are unaware of export opportunities. They don't know how to look at opportunity and capture it and create a plan that they can execute on to go forward. So that's just a huge problem. Lack of access to long-term capital is a clear problem. And finally, the inability to execute and the lack of a management bench. So there aren't that many professional managers that you can find if you're a small business owner. So these are some of the major problems that that small business entrepreneurs face. Now, because they represent, in our view, such an enormous potential to fight poverty and drive long-term change, systemic change in society, you know, we kind of got to thinking, well, why is it that there aren't more business services for this group? And there's basically two reasons. One is that on the development side, lots of USAID and other development organizations, they don't have a lot of expertise in how you start a small business. It's a different skill set to some degree. And it's difficult. On the other hand, venture capitalists and commercially driven investors, they need to make money. They're looking for returns. And the size of the investments that we're talking about, $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, this kind of range, it's a very awkward amount of money in development finance. It's way too big for microfinance, but it's way too small for traditional capital. And that's why today there's now a name for this group, and it's called the missing middle. And if any of you go to Google.org's website, you'll see that the missing middle is one of their five main initiatives. And you're seeing a lot more interest in how do you help this group. So I wanted to just quickly tell you our model. How we've decided to try to address this challenge. This is actually a screenshot, a little bit distorted, but nonetheless a screenshot of the first half of our website. And on the bottom, we have our model. And essentially, we try to identify outstanding entrepreneurs. And we do this through a variety of business plan competitions and networks and other recruitment events. And we then connect them with our own staff and with teams of MBA students who often come down. We're right now in Nicaragua. And they look and they try to figure out what is the constraint to growth of this business and how can it be overcome. Does it need money to be overcome, or does it maybe just need a different business focus? And so, in a sense, these consultants provide what we like to think of as really top-notch professional consulting to a very small business in a developing country. The most promising businesses that evolve out of this consulting process, we work with them to see if they want to have a financial partnership with us. So the nonprofit manages a for-profit double bottom line venture capital fund, which is designed to create social as well as economic returns. And this fund will invest equity and debt in very promising entrepreneurs that we believe have the capacity to drive long-term growth. Finally, we'll take board seats and provide a lot of support and networking and leadership development for these entrepreneurs to ensure that they execute on the business plan. So in essence, the idea is to try to take some of the principles of venture capital development, which have worked very successfully in the United States and Europe, and modify them and apply them to small businesses in developing countries, working to create a community of entrepreneurs that can become role models and that operate in a way that proves to society that business can be part of the solution and that business, when done right, benefits an entire community, including the environment. So I'll just give you one example of one of our entrepreneurs, and we can talk more if you're interested in the Q&A. But we invested in a guy named Santos Reyes. He grew up in Nicaragua. He fled to Honduras during the Civil War, taught himself to read by candlelight because he wasn't allowed to study in the schools there because he was a refugee. His first job was as a shoe shiner. And as he became more and more involved in that industry, he decided that he wanted to be more than just a shoe shiner. So he learned how to manufacture shoes. Then he went to night school to learn how to start a small business. He started a small factory manufacturing shoes. And when we found him, he had about 15 employees in a very small factory making shoes and maybe making about $80,000 a year in revenue. Okay, all of his money goes to he's a widower. All of his money goes to his two daughters, who are both in private school. So this is the kind of guy that you want to support, because if he's successful and his children are successful, it's going to help the country. We've invested about $85,000 in his business. He has a new factory. He has been connected to a new distributor who is going to be distributing more and more of his shoes, and we're hoping that this business will become a real success story in the community and be able to employ a lot of people. Although it's very risky and we might lose all of our money. And that is the nature of venture capital. So that's a little bit of our story and our approach. And we hope that we're at the beginning of building an industry, just as Muhammad Yunus and others have helped to create a very vibrant microfinance industry.
Question for the group and ask for an individual answer, either during this afternoon session when we were talking about careers in microfinance and social entrepreneurship, or at dinner or tonight. Each of you have mentioned the word social or the phrase social return. If I'm a banker and I'm looking to invest, How do you measure social return? What does success mean? Camilla, let's start with you.
Were there this afternoon, you know, we want to see a financial return in microfinance, but we also want to see a social return. And it's been a big question for a number of years, how do you measure that? You know, there are different tools out there that are designed to assess impact, but nothing that really to date has taken a quantitative look at the clients of microfinance institutions and their progress out of poverty over time. One thing that Grameen Foundation has been doing, we've been sort of concerned about this because we want to be able to represent to investors and donors and the world at large that microfinance has a social impact as well as a financial impact, and it's just softer. It's harder to get your hands around the social impact question. We have a tool called the Progress Out of Poverty Index that we've developed along with the World Bank, and it's just being launched, and what it's designed to do is establish sort of a baseline set of data about a percentage of a microfinance institution's clients, so say 10% of the clients, and then it tracks them on an annual basis over time. So you're able to actually show over time the extent to which people's lives are improving, and it looks at some really simple indicators of the quality of the house they live in. Does it have a thatch roof or a wood roof or a tin roof? Do they have plumbing? Do they have electricity? Do the kids go to school? Do the kids get vaccinations? And then also, you know, some economic indicators too. So hopefully, you know, there are others in the industry working on similar initiatives. So hopefully we'll have just as, you know, strong quantitative concrete data on the social impact side as on the financial impact side soon.
Ben, how do you measure them?
Well, there's two tracks. There's a number of organizations that are working together to create common metrics for our industry. And we are going to buy into that and support that. But the bottom line is we'll take a baseline. Okay, this is the company now. And then we'll see how has that company changed as a result of our intervention. So, for example, what's the difference in revenue, in exports generated, in imports substituted, in taxes paid? How many new jobs have been created? What kind of jobs are those? Is the average job being? Does it have more benefits and is it paid better than similar jobs? We'll also benchmark our companies against other similar competitors in the same industry, and see, are there corporate social responsibility practices and policies, superior? And are they providing leadership to the small business community by saying that there does not have to be a real divorce between financial performance and social performance? In fact, the two go well together and can actually help each other. So these are, you know, some of the indicators that we look at. We also require our entrepreneurs to participate in creating a more entrepreneurial culture, because the fund is just one part of what we do. But we also work to raise the profile of entrepreneurship and lower the perceived cultural and financial risks of entrepreneurship to inspire more people to start ventures.
Hans, where are you on that?
It's very difficult to measure economic impact on microfinance, particularly because most of the clients we target work in the informal sector. And the informal sector, by definition, is a sector without any data. So for countries to measure increase in tax revenues or increase in income or GDP, it's hard because they don't manage the data. And in countries like in Africa, in Latin America, 60% of the population is informal, has an informal business. So what we have, and there is a lot of questions posed by economists saying, okay, what is really the impact here? Is microfinance helping your economies? And what we have tried to do, initially we evaluate some databases to see the growth of the different businesses, because we have this methodology where we capture actually and record business size, sales, every time we give a loan. So we had clients for 6-7 years with more than 15 loans. We had data for more than 100,000 clients in Colombia. So we decided, okay, let's do a statistical study about the growth of those businesses. And the problem we faced was that we realized that only 10% of those businesses were growing. But later we saw that that data was not necessarily true because we were facing against problems with the data collection. Our loan officers were very good collecting data from the business, but also we were requesting them to collect data from the household. And they were okay collecting other income, household incomes and household expenses. But they were not collecting very well the household assets, new assets. And what happens with this business is that all the revenues or the savings or the surpluses, they not necessarily invest in the same business. So the business sometimes stays the same or grows very slowly. And what they start doing is they start building more rooms in their houses and they start renting the rooms. Or they create a new business that is under our radar. We don't know that they have now two or three businesses because one business is managed by the son. So there were some of the problems with the data we had. So at the end, we didn't do more statistical analysis, and we start doing focus groups. And we start talking to people. And they were telling us different stories, and we produced a couple of documents about how microfinance impacted their lives. And basically, it's a similar story that he was telling about people being able to move from a very small business to a medium size, able to diversify their businesses, able to build better houses and provide education to their kids. And that's what you can see, I will say, at least in 50% of the cases, where you see a improvement, gradual improvement in their lives. However, it's difficult to measure, you know? And we have empirical evidence only. And there are several universities and government agencies doing more econometric statistical analysis, monitoring several groups with and without loans through 3, 4, 5 years, very expensive, but still is not so accurate.
Why women? Most of Grameen's clients and most of Women's World Banking clients are women. And is it the same with you, Ben? Are you most of your entrepreneurs women? And if not, why?
Camila, you want to start?
Sure. Hans and I expect we'll have similar answers. There is research showing that in many countries and many situations, women are the better credit risk. They're more likely to pay back their loans. And this is for a number of reasons. One, they tend to be looking out for the welfare of the family. They tend to, in some cases, be more responsible with their money than men in certain situations. You know, they're sort of the classic example, I don't know how true it is, but that, you know, when men have money in certain developing country situations, they'll gamble or buy cigarettes or buy alcohol.
Never happens here, right?
and the women tend to invest it in their children, in their children's health, and children's education, or to reinvest it back in the business. So there is evidence that women in general tend to be the better credit risk. That's not to say we don't have a lot of men clients too. I think overall, of the 4 million clients we work with through our microfinance institution partners, about 82% are women. So, you know, there are great men clients out there too, but we've just found that the greater social impact and the lesser risk is for women.
We have faced some challenges. Traditionally, we have been majority of our clients women working through the group loans. When we started introducing the individual loans that were targeting larger business, we realized that the percentage of women managing larger business, particularly in Southeast Asia, was very limited. And the impact of introducing larger loans has been that that particular portfolio has only 20 to 30% women as clients. Not in Africa or Latin America, where women are also very much present in small and medium-sized businesses. So we have seen the negative impact, if you want, reaching women with larger loans, but this because it's a reflection of what happens in the markets, because of many, I would say, cultural aspects. In India, Pakistan, women have some limitations to do business in a larger scale. So I think that goes beyond microfinance. It's more working to integrate women and giving them more opportunities in the economy.
So Ben, where does it fit on your scale?
Well, it's definitely something that we measure and that we care about a lot. The slight majority of the entrepreneurs that we work with are men. However, many of the entrepreneurs are teams, and it's a couple, and they work together. And sometimes it's the man who had the idea, and other times it's the woman who had the idea. It really comes down 50-50. But I'll tell you one story, and this goes to the idea that women are a better credit risk. And we had one team of two entrepreneurs, both women, and they had a baby food product, an organic baby food product, which was really good, and we were very excited about helping them. But they were really a very micro business, and we finally decided that we wanted to make an investment in them. And at the end of the day, the deal fell through because they basically felt that they were not sure that they were going to be able to repay our money, and they were afraid that they were going to lose the money, and that that would make them look bad. And they liked us, and they just they weren't willing to take that risk, and so we never ended up investing in them, and we may at a later stage. But you know, I think maybe they knew more than we did that maybe it wasn't a good investment at the time.
One more question before we open it up to the floor. We were talking this afternoon and again at dinner and tonight about the regions, the geographies where this activity is focused. And unless I'm imagining it, I'm not hearing the Middle East. And am I imagining that, or is that a fact?
For Grameen Foundation, we actually are active in the Middle East. We tend to lump it into the Middle East, North Africa region, so the Arab world, we call it. And we're working very actively in Yemen, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and then Tunisia and Morocco as well, but and what's interesting there, I know Women's World Banking is in that region too. What's been interesting for us is to see that it's just a completely different cultural dynamic in that part of the world. And probably 50% of our clients in that region are women, and the rest are men, obviously. But what we're finding is that often in the markets, you know, typically a typical microfinance client works in the market. That's where they sell their goods if they're in trade. But a lot of the market sellers in those countries are men. It's just not traditional for the women to be out there in class. And so it may be a family business. You know, the man may be out there, you know, the face of the business in the market, and the women may be at home producing whatever it is they're selling. But it does still tend to be a family business. So you could argue that the family is still benefited as well. But there are a whole host of different challenges for me in that region.
Yeah. Also, they are latecomers, definitely. The countries Morocco, Egypt, they do have large microfinance institutions, but their history goes back 10 years maybe, while in other regions it's 20 years. No? So it's developing, and now the Emirates Arab, Dubai, they have created a big fund for microfinance. It's a government fund, or I don't know. And they are trying to do greenfield banking. No? And so probably in the next 5 to 10 years, that will grow more and more.
Yeah. And does your model, Ben, translate to the Middle East, do you think?
Yeah, I think it does. We certainly haven't thought about it. But, you know, we're in one country, Nicaragua. We decided to go to drill deep rather than spread ourselves thin in the beginning, make our mistakes and get our, you know, really get on the learning curve in one place. And the whole idea behind our model is that it is scalable, and that you can replicate it almost anywhere. Certainly, you would have to modify it. But it all really depends on having real local leaders on the ground from those countries who are, to some degree, giving their own political and social networks and putting them in the service of entrepreneurs that they don't know. And in a lot of these smaller, very closed societies, access to those kind of networks is a huge barrier. And that's part of what we're trying to do with our model, is open up those networks.
So can we open it up to questions now? Okay.
Ed, one of you mentioned before, there's a huge demand for microfinance, and because of that, microfinance is not limited to the traditional NGOs, institutions anymore. It's now open to the capital market. And I've read somewhere, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've read somewhere that Merrill Lynch, J.P. Morgan are also entering the microfinance world. And with that advance, the microfinance is open to like big capital resources. However, it's also open to risk. And what do you think something like a credit crunch right now would cause to microfinance? And what's that impact on the poor people?
Do you want to aim that at someone in particular?
No.
Okay. Who's?
It's up to you.
Yeah. Great question. And it's something we're looking at really closely, watching very closely right now. And what we're seeing is two very distinct patterns in terms of the impact of the credit crunch on microfinance. Many microfinance institutions get most of their funding locally, from local commercial banks or other local financial sources. In most of the markets we work, they've been relatively isolated from the credit turmoil we've seen in Europe, in the US, and OECD countries, including Japan as well. So we have not seen an impact in most of the countries we work on liquidity in the local sector, on microfinance institutions' ability to access capital. When you look at international capital flows to microfinance, completely different story. A number of the big investment banks or corporate banks that have recently gone into microfinance, one of the big New York-based investment banks on a no-name basis was arranging a large structured financing for a group of microfinance institutions and has put that on hold because of the sort of jitters in the U.S. and Europe and the fact that microfinance is for many people, considered a risky asset class, and many people kind of equate that with what's been going on in the subprime markets. How is it different? It's not clear in many people's minds why it's different. So we have seen somewhat of a tightening in credit flows from U.S. and Europe, commercial credit flows, not sort of philanthropic or social capital, to microfinance institutions. But we haven't seen that impacting their operations yet because there's sufficient local capital.
What we have seen also is that there is many new investment funds that are willing to lend to microfinance institutions. And everyone is chasing the best institutions. So what I think should happen in the future is that some of those investment funds should actually partner with microfinance institutions to replicate successful models, because right now the bottleneck is not the funding. Of course, right now in this particular time, there has been kind of a slowdown, especially from the US and Europe, because of all the subprime problems. But before that, you could see a lot of supply and very few good institutions, retailers, that could absorb that money. And we can only mention today one or two big investment banks that are partnering with Asha. Asha is a Bangladeshi group with more than 4 million clients. It's a large microfinance bank. And it's a group from the Netherlands, I think, that is partnering with them $150 million to replicate that model in new countries. So that, I think, is a more aggressive. They are taking more risks, but also they are enabling the growth of this industry. And there are a lot of investment bankers that are kind of just, how do you say, cherry picking? The best ones, and waiting and expecting high returns. Those type of investors we don't welcome, because we need more. I think the bankers need to act like bankers and take more risks and not just take advantage of good opportunities. No, I think we need to reach a balance. And I think there are good bankers, and there are also bankers that are more opportunistic. And we need to also, as a microfinance network, choose with whom we will work in the future. But I think we are in a very interesting time today where you see all these things happening.
Some of my banking brothers would say that it's easier and better risk to lend to a Bangladeshi villager to buy a sewing machine than it is to do mortgage lending in Cleveland. So,
yeah, definitely.
Somebody on this side?
Yeah, obviously, microfinancing is risky and carries a premium. My question is the default rate on microloans significantly greater than it is on any other loan, frankly?
I mean, to the contrary.
Why it would establish the premium, I guess, is the question. That's the first. And the second question is, how do you deal with corruption?
First question. The default rate globally for microfinance institutions is about 2% per year. So the write-off rate, extremely low. I think credit card write-offs in the U.S., not up until this latest credit crunch, were about 6, 7%. So just to give you an idea, it's in every sense, a better risk. It's just unfamiliar to commercial bankers. They don't quite know what to make of it. And one of the points that Hans made, that it's collateral-free lending, it's based on the social capital principle, that's hard for a lot of people to get their heads around. And, you know, it's perceived as being much riskier than it is, so there is this risk premium. But that's starting to change. You're starting to see the margins come down. Corruption? Do you want to take that one,
yeah,
Hans?
Yeah.
Well done, very.
Corruption, I can talk at least from our network members. And there has been in the past some issues in institutions because lack of controls. And I will say that problem probably affects 10% of the institutions in microfinance, or maybe a little bit more, but more and more, thanks to strategic alliances with consulting firms and banks, we have been improving our operational systems, our internal audit controls, and frauds are kind of more manageable now. No, I will say that this is one of the risks some institutions still face, microfinance institutions, but I will say that in the last 5 years has been big improvements in transparency, how they report, and the accuracy of the financial statements they produce, and second, on the controlling the operations and internal controls. I think we are in a good path. But in the past, that was one issue. And many institutions claim to have 2% repayment or arrears, and in reality, they probably had more. No, but it was a problem of reporting.
And do you have a default rate that's significantly different than that? Or?
Well, we invest a lot of equity as well as debt, so it's kind of unclear. The debt that we have put on our companies, it's 100% been repaid. But we don't have any collateral requirements. So in many ways, what we're doing is very, very risky. And certainly, you know, how do you sell the equity? How do you exit those investments is a big question. And there are a lot of strategies for doing that. On the corruption question, I would say that for our companies, it is an issue. Probably a bigger issue is that if you're a small business person, it's just the government is not necessarily on your side in terms of helping you to do what you need to do to get it up and running. And you know, in the United States, it's just a couple days to incorporate, to get all the legal paperwork. It's not that expensive. It's just a totally different situation in many developing countries. And so we are trying to focus on that as a way where maybe we can add some value by helping to tell the stories of entrepreneurs who've had to face all kinds of problems from low-level, you know, bureaucrats, and because of regulations and laws that don't make any sense, or that were designed to protect big business and not help create an innovative culture. And we're trying to document that, write it up in case studies, get the business schools involved, and maybe go and talk to legislators about how we can fix it. Because certainly bad policy is a factor in not creating an innovative, dynamic culture.
I was going to comment on the whole thing. It seems to me that the problem isn't with the institutions necessarily, but with the actual customer. And from the individual entrepreneur facing lots of barriers to getting things done, and what kind of a block that really is. And it must be enormous in most countries.
Yep.
Yeah. But I think that the interesting point with micro-entrepreneurs that they have lived all their lives in a situation that is very antagonic to them. It's very difficult for them. And they have been able to succeed instead of those difficult situations. So micro-entrepreneurs live in crisis situations. They live in economies that are in permanent turmoil. And they somehow, because they are so small, they are very flexible and they move. So in a sense, they are less risky than large companies in developing countries because of their small size.
Story about how overregulation and corruption affects micro-entrepreneurs. And a country I spent a good deal of time working in the Balkans, most micro-entrepreneurs sold their produce at the local markets. And, of course, wouldn't sort of print out a receipt when you bought your cucumbers or whatever. And the government, as part of a regulation package to try to standardize business, started insisting that every market seller had to have a certain receipt machine and had to give every person who bought even one carrot an actual sort of physical digitally printed receipt. And so many people are making, $3 a day. They can't afford to go out and buy this machine. And to make matters worse, there was only one brand of machine they were allowed to buy that was imported by some minister's son. And so you had this ridiculous situation where these market women were, they knew there were officials circulating in the market trying to catch them. So they had to purchase this machine, and were operating at a loss, and some of them didn't and just took the risk of getting a fine. But, there are examples like that all the time that just, people are working against these kinds of forces and succeeding.
I'd like to ask a question about sustainability, if I could, perhaps going back to your idea of the missing middle. That is the transition from microcredit to commercial credit, using recent experience in Angola, where they're dealing with the poorest of the poor, where it takes 148 days to start a business, with all the corruption that goes along with that. There are three NGOs that have been using microcredit: World Vision, Development Workshop, and Catholic Relief Services. Catholic Relief Services says that it has graduated some farmers' groups to commercial credit. Development Workshop acts as a bank. World Vision decides not to act as a bank, and the government's trying to prevent NGOs from acting as a bank now that the post-war reconstruction has been in for 6 years. They're trying to move away from NGOs acting as banks, develop their embryonic banking sector. So the question is, according to USAID, the motivation for a commercial banker, and they've started up a commercial bank which has had mixed success in Angola, is not compelling because they find that although they can get 40% returns if they wait 4 years for a payback, they're not set up to be able to do that. Somehow the numbers I may be a little bit off in, but there's a longer payback, expected payback, and there is very high returns. Now, on the other side, that could motivate them is that these people are extremely loyal to, as you probably know, I think that the people who receive microcredit develop tremendous loyalty to the lender. So, however, they haven't reached the formula yet. And I'm wondering, is there any initiative, is there any bridge in mind to make that transition from microcredit to commercial credit, which I think gets to the question also that the economists want to know, will this make an impact on the economy? How will it be integrated in the economy? Only if it can make such a transition. I mean, if you make 400 sewing shops in a vast slum, eventually they start competing with each other, and eventually they need more than microcredit. So I wonder if there is anything underway in that area.
Anyone take a crack at that?
Well, I can't speak to innovations in the field of microfinance, and there may be a lot of innovations which maybe you guys can talk about. I know that it's from what I have seen, it is a real challenge. So we have talked to the presidents of a number of microfinance institutions in Nicaragua, and we've said to them, hi, we're looking for a pipeline. We're looking for your very best entrepreneurs that we can come in and take them to the next level, invest 100 grand equity so they can grow their business. Who can we meet? And they don't have anybody for us to meet. And in part, it's because, you know, when you are investing in a small business, you're really investing in the management team. And the management team, you know, they're all levels of entrepreneur and of courage and of loyalty and of all these great qualities. But you need a certain base level of education and perspective to be able to kind of grow a business. And it's just been very difficult finding really good entrepreneurs. And I'm not talking about just in microfinance. Even people who have graduated from, you know, or gotten a great education, it's just hard to find great entrepreneurs to invest in. So I think I'm hoping that there is more work being done in this area by microfinance institutions, because we certainly would love to be able to have more of them graduate. And I know that the banks are doing some work on this too, but the banks typically, they're making an enormous amount of money with basically eliminating risk from their portfolio through extremely high collateral requirement. And they really are masters at eliminating risk. And the kind of loans that they're giving are short-term loans. They're not the kind of loans that you need to grow a business. So I think that there needs to be more competition within the banking sector. And one of the things we're hoping to do is provide more competition and show that that there are a lot of businesses that are off the radar screen of the banks that represent enormous opportunity for the banks to make money. But the banks need to actually take a risk and compete. Mm-hmm. But I think that you'll see in the future a lot more focus on that area, because it really is very important to graduate more of these entrepreneurs, you know, to a formal economy, company that can export, that can really generate jobs and revenue.
So Camille and Hans, do you compete? Do you consider yourselves competitors? You have a fairly similar business model. You have some overlap geographies. Are you like Chase and Citi, where we're tripping over each other every time we go in to see a client?
I think the market is big. We are in some similar countries, similar cities, sometimes same cities in many cases. But still, there are few countries where you really feel the strong competition. No? Bangladesh is one of those. But India, you can grow and grow whatever you want to grow. Latin America, some countries you feel competition. But the Middle East, again, is Africa is open. So I think there is a lot of potential today. And going back to your question, IFC from the World Bank also, and the IDB from the Inter-American Development Bank, both have created programs to support banks to target the small and medium enterprises. No? So now there is a big emphasis of this multilaterals to support formal banks in kind of targeting some of the missing middle that he was referring to.
Anything, Tom?
Hi. To begin, thank you very much for being here tonight. I found it very informative. I have two questions. The first is, you mentioned that the average interest rate is around 30%. My first question is that norm across the board depending on the country? And you say that it is, you know, lower than what they would be getting through other means, which I do understand. But when you're looking at the overall model where you see such high returns on the money that you're giving out, why do you choose to set it at such a high rate? And I understand the risk behind it, but with such a high return, that is something that I'd like to have clarified. Mm-hmm. And the second question is a little more broad. Where do you see microfinance going in the future? Obviously, you're trying to hit a new market, a new segment that has not been maybe channeled as much. Do you see it going more specialized like that in the future, or staying as broad as it is now?
Interest rates are a hot topic always. And I think microfinance institutions initially, when they developed the new methodologies, those methodologies were expensive. No, in some countries where competition is high, interest rates had come down. You have several examples of that, Colombia, Bolivia, Bangladesh, and Uganda, no, where competition is driving down interest rates. I think that when competition starts strengthening, you will see many of the microfinance institutions lowering their interest rates. I think that's a trend that you will see more and more. And I don't think it's bad. Initially, when you develop a market and you have almost a monopoly, of course you will exert some benefits of it. No, but what happened in Mexico, it's very important. Compartamos did an IPO. They received 12 times the value in books. They are charging 80%, 100% interest rates a year. And that has opened the eyes of many other institutions, many other banks. And I bet you that in 3-5 years from now, Mexico will have a lot of very strong institutions competing for that market. And that will reduce the interest rates in the future.
Camilla?
The overall interest rate structure in a particular country, you can't necessarily compare interest rates in the U.S. versus interest rates in Nigeria, for example. So, you know, a better sort of benchmark to look at when you're looking at the interest rate of a microfinance institution is the local corporate lending rate. What are banks lending to kind of the top-tier corporates at in that country? There's another reference rate or interbank rate. It kind of tells you what the base rate is to borrow at zero risk in that country. In a lot of African countries, it's unbelievably high. In the U.S., or LIBOR right now is what, about just under 4%, I think. In Nigeria, the interbank rate's about 18%. So that's no risk for a very sort of standard $1 million loan to a corporation. You add on the extremely high operational costs for microfinance institutions to get, as Hans mentioned, many, many loans out to rural areas, the personal touch. A lot of microfinance institutions don't make the client come to them. They go to the client. So instead of having someone have to leave their market stall for 2 hours to make a payment, they get on a motorbike and go to the market and collect the payments. So clients are paying for convenience, the access to capital, the fact that the microfinance institution has higher operational costs. So, you know, as Hans said, interest rates are coming down where we see competition, but they're always going to be higher than lending rates in the U.S. So you just think of it in a developing country context rather than comparing what we would pay to borrow money in the U.S. But it's a hot topic at the moment, and one that should be given a lot of attention, I think.
Well, to the question about the growth of the industry, right now in developed wealthy countries, the small business sector makes up over half of GDP. In developing countries, it makes up about 15% of GDP. There is an enormous amount of growth in the small business sector worldwide. And that growth is going to need financing. It's going to need financial products. It's going to need insurance products. It's going to need a lot of products that exist but haven't yet been rolled out. And so I think you're going to see an enormous amount of growth and innovation worldwide in this sector.
Regarding your question about what's next, what are the next innovations? I think microfinance, we have figured out the working capital loans, done. Now we are focusing in more longer-term loans, housing loan, mortgages. We are also becoming more knowledgeable on providing longer-term loans to fix assets and that. But I think we are now starting also to think about other type of financial service, for example, pensions. Long-term savings. No, how you will help poor people in developing countries when they become elder. No, today they depend on families, and they become a burden for many families, and then many of them are abandoned. No, so we need to develop some long-term savings where you will kind of build a network of the relatives, the daughters that maybe they will contribute together, and that nest will help. And so we are discussing with some pension funds and insurance companies, how can we crack this problem? Another big problem is health insurance. Everyone gives life insurance. Everyone is willing to, you pay me $3 or $1 a month, and when you die, I will give you $20,000. What's that? No, but nobody really. AIG, we have talked with all the major insurance companies. Nobody wants to provide health insurance for low-income clients. So, and that's also a big problem that we are trying to see how we solve that. No? And these are probably the tasks for you guys.
Can I get into your health insurance program? Because mine's costing me more every year, and I'm getting less.
So those kind of future areas of development.
Yes, hi, my name is Bela Hovind. I'm at the UN in New York. I think the seminar is very interesting, and thank you very much for pointing out that entrepreneurship is really essential for development. I'm very glad that that's coming out from different viewpoints. It reminded me of last week, I don't know whether you read in the newspaper, that Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, was having a meeting at Wall Street, actually, with investment banks. So I think this collaboration is very important. There's also something which is called the Global Compact, where the United Nations is having a dialogue with private business. And the comment on USAID, I thought, was very interesting, that you were looking there to see whether there was interest, and unfortunately you didn't find a lot. Luckily, in the multilateral institutions, the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, there is some interest, but I would say I would encourage you to continue knocking on that door and make sure that these administrators of these development programs also get an interest in funding the type of activities that you're interested in. I had a quick question following up on an earlier comment about the relationship between microfinance and the formal sector, and I think we've heard from two persons in the room present their views, and I would like to hear the views of the two other persons. I don't know whether it's allowed to ask the moderator to comment on the interest of the bank that he is representing, that he is working in. Do you see a market? Do you think that people who have benefited from microfinance in the past are becoming interested clients for commercial banking activities? And similarly, with the foundation you're working at, do you see in practice people who have benefited from the type of finance that you're working on making that step actually and having access to the formal sector? I do agree that that is a very important step for the transition to real development, sustainability, and scaling up the type of activities that we're all wonderfully working at.
Okay. I'm going to answer your question in kind of a different way. There are a number of microfinance institutions that are starting to convert to microfinance banks. So they're intending to be full-service banks for their clients, no matter how big they get. And in fact, those are the clients they want to keep, the ones with, you know, the good track record, the larger loan size that's easier to service. So I think we're going to start to see, as you know, we see more and more microfinance institutions converting into actual commercial banks with a focus on microfinance, less of a distinction or less of a need to depart the microfinance sector to get a commercial loan. Right now, I would agree with my two colleagues up here. We don't see a lot of clients jumping from microfinance institutions to commercial banks, but things are changing really rapidly. In a lot of the markets we're working in, when you ask the microfinance institutions what their main competition is, they may name the microfinance institution down the road. More and more, they're starting to name commercial banks. We saw the big Spanish bank, BBVA, acquire two microfinance institutions in Peru last year. So commercial banks are starting to see this as an attractive market segment. And maybe they'll make acquisitions that give them access to it. Maybe they'll open special windows that focus on this sector. So I think things are changing, and I was thinking earlier, I don't know if this gets to the missing middle. You know, they may see a big market in $500, $1,000 loans. Do they see a big market in the $100,000 investments? I don't know.
I would answer on behalf of the large commercial banks rather than specifically J.P. Morgan, because J.P. Morgan doesn't have a retail branch network outside the United States, and it's not our footprint to be lending to individuals in emerging markets. It's just not what we do. But is it an attractive segment for commercial banks in general? Absolutely. I read before Christmas that Citibank is installing a system of ATMs throughout in very remote villages in India where nobody can read. And the challenges of getting people, teaching them how to use an ATM and actually have, you know, and getting money into that ATM and having the instructions be legible for people who can't read. The huge challenges that are involved in that. Those big banks are willing to spend the money to that's sort of the holy grail. 95% of the people in the world don't have bank accounts. So when you convert them, these guys are going to do all the legwork, and then the commercial banks will come in once they're bankable and sell them life insurance and everything else. But yes, I think it is very, very interesting to commercial banks. We among other banks, have set up a social lending group. And I'm not sure, I don't think that we're going to be actually making microloans. I think we'll be looking to do more of the investment banking activity that people like Grameen and Women's World Banking need to support them, perhaps helping them with foreign exchange issues and things like that. But I don't see us actually doing the loans for the sewing machines in Bangladesh.
And so. I wanted to make one clarification based on your comment. What I was trying to say is that I think one of the problems with a missing middle is that it needs a TA component and it needs a investment component to really make it work. You can't divorce the two. Each of those have different funding sources. So USAID is not going to be investing capital in small businesses. It's not what they do. So you need to find other investors who want to do that. But USAID is very good at investing in technical assistance, and they care very deeply about small business development. So actually, we our Nicaraguan affiliate is funded by USAID. And so we're big fans of USAID and are, you know, very grateful for the support that they've given us in Nicaragua. But again, the model would not work if it only had that component. You need to have an investment component that is linked as well.
J.P. Morgan, just as information, gives away about $100 million a year through its foundation. And some of that money goes in the form of grants to startup businesses or other socially responsible entrepreneur situations. So we're not really calling it microfinance, but I think to a degree we and all of the big banks have been involved in that, probably without calling it that. So that was a good question. Thank you. Didn't think I had to answer anything as the moderator.
I just want to echo previous statements. Thank you for coming. It's been very informative. This question is kind of from a different perspective from questions before, a bit more cultural, but what degree of, I guess, hostility, if any, have you ever encountered where you're coming from a wealthy, organized industry and you're coming into these countries, especially in the case of providing investment advice and everything? Have you ever encountered resistance or hostility to your actions?
The microfinance institutions we partner with are all local. They were founded by local people, are staffed by local people, they're 100% local. And they see us as a partner that can provide things they can't get in their own country. It could be capital, it could be specific technical expertise, it could be technology. So there's certainly cultural differences, but there has been, you know, in my experience, just a very high level of cooperation and mutual respect. We also have a number of people from the countries we work in on our staff in Washington, D.C. So it's an interesting question, and I'm trying to think of an example where we've seen that, and I can't think of a situation. You know, certainly cultural differences, but not sort of outright hostility to a U.S.-based organization coming in to provide advice or
also,
financing.
People view these organizations as partners that are working with them to solve some
issues that they have in the field. So even clients, when they work with you, they have a very welcome attitude. And when you see us traveling those countries, we go in very small cars, no protection, with the staff. And sometimes you see the USAID staff going with these big SUVs, 3-4 black SUVs. It's an aggression also for them. So it depends how you move in the countries and how you show yourself to them. So there will be some American companies and non-profits that really try to integrate more themselves with the countries, and they also view you as helping their country. So in our particular case, we had not have ever a problem with we were hijacked or threatened. Only one situation in Jordan last year was a bombing in a Hyatt, I think, hotel. And one of our staff was staying there. So there were like 15 people killed. And she was lucky enough to be in the 10th floor. Nothing happened to her. But it was because it was an attack towards a big American hotel. And she was there. But that was the only case where we saw this type of accident.
I mean, one thing when you're working with entrepreneurs is the good ones, they're relentlessly practical. So if you are helping them solve their business problem, that is what is important to them. It doesn't really matter, your background, as long as you can help them. But the bigger question, I think, is how do you overcome one of the most crippling problems of very poor countries, which is trust, building trust. This is a huge issue, and we spend a lot of time on it. And actually, the fact that we are based in the United States, even though most of our staff is in Nicaragua and is Nicaraguan, helps us. Because actually, people are much more willing to trust an international organization than they are to trust their neighbor. And the real trust issue is internal, in the culture, because there's... In very poor countries, you'll find there's absolutely no trust. And trust, like finance, is a lubricant of society. It helps move things along. But if you have no trust, everything goes to a standstill.
Speaking of hostility, I can say as a New York banker, I've met with hostility in every city in this country. Especially, forgive me, whenever I go to Boston. So. Next. We have one here.
In your capacity as a strategic and educational resource for these fledgling companies, how do you outline attainable but challenging benchmarks for success so that these companies can renew loans and perhaps get a higher borrowing amount from you guys?
Well, for us, we have a business plan that has key milestones. And we don't make an investment unless we think that they are going to put the money to good use and have a real plan for it. And then we have monthly meetings with the entrepreneur, and we create monthly progress reports to see are you on track and to identify major issues that we can try to address them early on before they become too difficult.
You're lending to a group of, say, five women, you're essentially devolving or delegating kind of the credit screening responsibility to them. So you don't go in and do a thorough analysis of each of their businesses. It would just be too time intensive for the size of the loan. And what you're trusting is that because they've picked to be in a group with each other and they've agreed to support each other if one of them can't come up with their payments, that they're doing the screening. And so, most microfinance institutions that operate on the group lending methodology aren't going to do sort of extensive analysis of each individual micro business. When you start to get to the individual loan level, yes, there are certain benchmarks that you would look for.
Individual loans is a little different. You look at the repayment rate of the last loans, and then you will do an analysis of the repayment capacity, and based on those two informations, you will increase the loan amount. We don't look too much at the guarantees because that for us is not so important.
I'm told we have time for one more question.
I just wanted to clarify something that you were saying earlier when you said you were talking about looking towards the future and talking about pensions and that sort of implementation. That seems to me sort of a model that sort of follows the U.S. and Western business schemes. Are there other sort of innovations you see happening in the microfinance industry that are more, I guess, culturally specific to sort of other cultures? I guess that sort of jumps off the culture question.
I don't know if I understand your question correctly. Innovations in the microfinance field, basically what we are trying to do is provide with all the spectrum of financial services to low-income clients. We started with working capital. Next, we moved to fixed asset loans, housing loans, consumption loans that are repaid with the business. And now we are looking at health and pensions. No? These, for us, are kind of the key services you need to have access. But I don't know if what type of innovations you mean, more on technology or...
Financial innovations besides sort of the natural progression.
Financial innovation, what we are working also is developing scoring models for microfinance. And we are trying also to automatize the lending process with PDAs and the different devices to lower the transactional cost. And the third innovation is trying to reduce the transactional cost at the distribution channels. What he was saying about the ATMs that speaks to you in your language when you don't know how to read them, or the mobile banking. Those are technological innovations that will help microfinance increase the outreach.
Yeah, just a couple of examples. You know, one of the analogies that people are starting to use is microfinance as a platform for other products and services to get to the client base. And so, you know, health services, health education, health insurance, that would be one bucket. Crop insurance for agricultural loans. So, you know, there are all kinds of innovations that could be specific to the local financial sector, but where maybe you can draw on expertise from countries where these have been established for a while. But what microfinance institutions do have is they all have loan products that are designed for the local culture. So you have, you know, in India you have festival loans that are just short-term loans right before festivals so people can buy, you know, the stock up on food or whatever they need before festival time. You have school loans, things like that, health loans. So there are products that are designed given the local cultural context and local needs that microfinance institutions design on their own because clients demand them. So I think, you know, you've got the client demand for one, and then you've got sort of the international or local domestic financial sector influences coming from there, like insurance and pensions, but then there's also client-driven products being developed.
The question of culture, we had one company that we worked with really sort of responsible entrepreneurs. They had this idea of creating a pool of healthcare for their employees, and their employees would contribute, you know, $1 or $30, the company would match it $3. And we thought, oh, this is great, because none of these employees had any healthcare. And it was a complete and utter failure because the employees did not value. And that may have been a very rational decision for them. And so, you know, I think for a lot of the companies that we work with, cash is being paid. And we have the bottom of the pyramid. Insurance is kind of ridiculous. You don't have that time value money, you don't have that long term, you need money now, and that's a new value. So they've changed. And now they have a profit sharing plan.
Please join me in thanking our four panelists, Ben Powell, Camila Nestor, Craig Weeks, and Hans Delian for this very informative program. And on behalf of the Clark Forum, as a token of our appreciation, we'd like to offer you each with a plaque of the poster that was advertising this event.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Looks nice.
This concludes our program. Thank you all for attending. Hope you have a nice evening.